This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to the Transformation Platform. We are joined in the studio now by Mari Shabant. He's the Director of Cigna Advisors, and we're talking triple B ownership structures. I want to say Mari is a regular on this program. It's good to have you back again, Mari.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Excellent. Yeah, I was going to say, Murray's got his reserved parking downstairs and his reserved seat in studio. Welcome back, Murray. Thanks for being
I just wish I was talking about something a bit simpler.
Like performance management.
The performance of the Lions on the weekend.
That's true. Yeah. Well, Richard Angus and Louis are also in the studio. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Appreciate being
welcome, here. Louis.
Thanks, Ellis.
Okay. So, Richard, you're going to kick us off on this part.
Yeah.
Transformation, empowerment, black ownership, and so forth.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the when anybody sees the word triple BEE, immediately the question that kind of comes to the fore is, okay, so you know, we've got a new scorecard, we've got new things that we need to consider, different elements. But I think the one that's kind of up there and is on the, let's call it the tip of everybody's tongue, is this whole question around ownership, because that's one of the key pillars that we and elements that we need to look at. It's probably the one that people try not to talk about the most, because it's a difficult one. I think there's also the element of it's quite complex to understand. I think some of the other pillars and elements are a little easier to get your hands around. I think we're still trying to interpret a lot of things in that ownership space. Mary, just as a starting point, I mean, when we talk about ownership, there are three fundamental elements principles that need to be satisfied around ownership. What are those? Talk us through the elements that we need to be thinking about and talking about.
I think the most important thing around ownership is that it's probably the most emotive aspect of BEE as well, because if you think about it from the point of view of a family-owned business that's been in generations, now suddenly the question of, well, who and should own this business in the current BEE legislation is quite an important one. But to answer your question on the three principles of ownership, when the BEE codes were drafted, the legislator had in mind that ownership really represents different rights of ownership. And the one right of ownership that they wish to measure is the voting rights of the shareholder over the direction that the business takes. Mm-hmm. So there's a voting right. The second right is a right to economic interest. And that basically means the fruits of the business as it produces fruits, which are generally profits. What is the business owner's rights to the economic interest? And then the third one is effectively the owner's right to the net value that accrues as the business grows. So if you think about starting a business, it's really worth nothing when you start the business, and hopefully over a few years' time, you've grown the value of that business so that someone might come to you and say, well, I really like your business, I'd like to buy that business. That value is the net value that that has accrued to that business over time. So those three rights are measured separately in the BEE codes of good practice. And what's happened, what tends to happen is each of those rights gets looked at separately. And so we're seeing there's a proliferation of structures in the marketplace where voting rights are separated from the economic interest rights, which are separated from the net value rights, and different people have different percentages or allocations of these rights, and it's made ownership structures quite complicated.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the one thing that I'm seeing out there is complexity when it comes to ownership structures, and I'm seeing a call and a requirement from many business owners to say, this is just too complex, can we please simplify this? I want a simple structure, I want to be able to go about doing my business, not spending my time managing my ownership structure per se.
Absolutely.
So that's, you know, that's kind of the flip side of it. One of the biggest questions that is out there is where do we go with things like employee share trusts? I mean, these things were were not seen as the solution, but was almost the response under the old codes to the whole question of, let's call it, broad-based ownership structures, and that's changing.
Well, I think one must always remember that the legislation is fairly clear in the BE codes, and I'd like to just read an extract from that to give you a sense of what the legislator is intending. Mm. And then to a large extent, I think very clever people can interpret this legislation and make life complex for ourselves. But if one looks at it, it says, the general principle when measuring the rights of ownership of any category of black people in a measured entity, only rights held by natural persons are relevant. If the rights of ownership of black people pass through a juristic person, like a company or a trust, then the rights of ownership of black people in that juristic person are measurable. The principle applies across every tier of ownership in a multi-tiered chain. Until that chain ends with a black person holding rights of ownership. So that the key is very clear here. Ownership rests with an individual. So a live human being, flesh and blood. Mm. And what we are seeing in the marketplace are potentially many ownership schemes where the ownership actually vests in a trust or in a company where it's very difficult to go and see who the human beings are that are ultimately the beneficiaries of that ownership.
Mm. It's quite interesting that, and I mean, you listen to this and I go, and I understand the concepts and the constructs and what they're trying to achieve, because they're trying to avoid people fronting things and ducking and diving things.
Correct.
But I then also, in the back of my mind, humorously think to myself, well, in actual fact, in the business world, as we all know it, there are many people that go to great lengths to hide behind corporate structures.
Correct.
that in fact remove themselves, forget the color issue, remove themselves from being that direct beneficial owner for a whole lot of very valid reasons. One of them being creating intergenerational companies, etc., etc.
Tax,
etc. And you look at this and you go, okay, great, but understand that in reality, the business world sometimes wants to do exactly what they're trying or saying let's not do. And I understand why. They're more focused on, okay, let's make sure it's not a front per se. But
correct.
At some point, once we're past all of this and let's move on 100 years, the very same people that are now being identified as that person, forget for the moment the color of the skin issue, that very same person is going to be working very hard to get the ownership out of their personal hands into the hands of their family trust for the next 150 years.
Sure.
It's quite an interesting
it seems like a bit of a contradiction, but I think the important thing, let's go back to your question about employee ownership.
Yeah.
Employee ownership is a well-proven business model across the globe. Many businesses where employees are the shareholders, there's evidence to show that those businesses outperform non-employee-owned companies in similar industries.
Exactly.
So employee-owned businesses...
It never used to be that way, though, Murray, right?
Internationally, yes.
Internationally, yes. Mm.
Maybe not so much in South Africa, because the way our employees' schemes have been designed is very different to how many of the schemes are applied in other countries.
Yeah.
But if we go back to the first principles of ownership, which I described in the actual BE codes, the document, looking at voting rights, economic interest, and net value, and you look at how employee ownership schemes are generally constructed here in South Africa, typically employee ownership schemes sit in a trust where there are trustees that are appointed to administer this trust on behalf of the employees. And typically, the employees never get an opportunity to exercise their right to vote on any issue pertaining to the shareholding in the company. So immediately, the employees' voting rights, per se, are never properly exercised in a lot of the schemes that I've seen. Mm. And now immediately you're violating one of the first principles that the DTI and the BE codes are asking for in the document.
But Marian, I mean, Marian, let me just ask you.
But isn't that a two-way sort of dichotomy, though, Murray? Because employees, too, have to do their legwork to understand what sort of participation they ought to bring on board to understand the dynamics of the structure.
Well, there's the education element, but I also kind of go, well, if there's this trust structure, you know, good old democracy, democracy we spoke of earlier. Let's everybody elect the trustees.
There's more of that.
And let's move on. You know, if you've got an employee trust and you've got employee elected trustees, they get the vote on behalf of the trustee base, and they need to have the knowledge. So, you know, best you vote for somebody that knows what they're doing as opposed to somebody who's
uninformed.
Yeah, but trustees
can also be imposed on you, right?
Well, I guess the question is, you know, so that goes to, so what is the intention of the share trust and how is it set up, et cetera?
I think that's the absolute key, because what the BEE is not saying is that trusts are not acceptable. In fact, there's a whole provision in the codes allowing for employee trusts and creating certain rules around that. And it's in particularly saying, provide employees with the opportunity to vote and elect the trustees on certain reserved matters. Let the employees be aware and let them cast their vote on what may happen with a distribution, for instance. So the BEE codes do make provision to allow trusts to happen. But the problem with the way many of the trusts are constituted is that those rights don't filter to the employees. So that's just one example. But another very good example, for instance, is let's say a rule is written into the trust that says, whilst you're an employee of the trust, you may receive the benefit. But if your employment with the company is terminated, you are no longer a beneficiary. Now, you've got to compare that situation with a situation where I, as an individual, might own a share in a listed company. I don't work for that company. I own the share. Whether I have a job or I don't have a job, I'm still the owner of that share. And so there's the thinking is going that why must my black ownership be dependent on my employment with a particular company?
But it gets worse, though, because I've seen something that says if you, whilst you're in the employ of the company and you get incapacitated to not be able to perform your duties,
you lose your benefit.
Meaning go home.
Yeah.
You lose your benefit.
Correct. I've seen schemes that do that.
I mean, how illegal can that be?
Well,
it's just legal speak, loophole. Okay.
But then let's contrast the reality of in most, if you're not dealing with a listed company, the reality is that virtually all shareholder agreements, regardless, I mean, this is now way outside of triple BEE, have
buyback agreements.
Have very similar
incapacity clauses. Yes.
So if you're incapacitated and you're in a partnership with me, sorry, I'm buying you out if you're not able to do what you're meant to do as my partner. And that's got nothing to do with BE. That's just a simple practicality.
But I think you said a very important word, buying out.
Buying out. Yeah. That's a distinction. Correct.
Yeah,
huge distinction.
And I mean, that's the fundamental. So there's a question of, well, if there's a value, and once again, all these things, there's always needs to be a value clause.
Correct.
What are we buying out at what value? And you fundamentally are almost, I guess, forced to accept that valuation clause because you entered the scheme on that same value clause and you exit on the same value clause and moving on.
The problem is that when one looks at many of the employee type schemes that are out there, they don't have those provisions. And that provision specifically isn't highlighted in the BEE codes as one of the provisions. But if one reads the general principle, which I read right at the beginning, one would logically conclude that that should be the principle. Yeah. However, the drafters of many of these employee shared trust agreements specifically exclude that particular right because, and this is a very big because, many verification agencies will still allow them full ownership points on their scorecard, even though the trust itself is inadequate. And as a result, you've seen a proliferation of what is known as, inverted commas, acceptable schemes, which really, when you look at the legislation, are not acceptable.
The other thing, and sorry to be the killjoy on this one, but there's two sides to this conversation. Remember that I said the value. Determine the value.
Correct.
So that means if you entered the scheme at 100 Rand and you're now leaving and resigning and the value of the company's actually declined for whatever reason and it's now at 90, get out your checkbook, staff member, and write a check for $10. Now, when that happens, you want to see employees running for the hills. And I go, well, hold on a second.
Are there unions in the corner there?
Hold on a second here.
It's called the risks and rewards of ownership.
Risks and rewards. And I think that's where a lot of stuff kind of immediately at that point hits the skids. And you say to employees, okay, you know, so let's set up the scheme. This and this is how it's going to work. And if you leave, you get the check for the value accrual, and if the value is declined over time, you then write the check for the difference on your exit. And they look at you and they go, oh, no, hold on a second. And I'm like, well, what do you mean hold on a second? That's the way the scheme works. You can't have upside without downside risk. That's ownership.
Only losses suddenly, are socialized, Richard. Come on.
No, but it's amazing how many people, when put to the test, I've personally done this test with people. I say, okay, so we're happy. This is how we're going to value the entity. And if the value goes up, this is what the number is. And if the value goes down, this is how the number works. The moment you talk about the value decline and the fact that they might have to write a check, whoa.
There is fortunately one.
That's not supposed to happen.
Yeah. Well, we're facing reality in South Africa at the moment.
Welcome to the realities of economics.
There is one provision that is made in the codes of good practice where companies and whichever ownership schemes are created are required to meet a net value criteria. And the net value criteria really says that over time, the debt component of any ownership transaction needs to be reduced such that positive net value is created in the hands of black shareholders from day one. So there is a mitigating clause in the codes, but you know, who's to say that the economic conditions might result in that not coming about? And often what you find in the drafting of particularly employee schemes is that the downside risk is shielded from the employees through the way that the schemes are crafted. But be that as it may, I think the most important thing that we've seen or certainly I've seen many examples of is employee share trusts where the true rights of ownership that are required to reside in an individual never actually get to the individual.
So now let's talk about these lovely let's move away from the employee share trust per se, as it, you know, so individuals that are employed by the company, and let's move to an educational trust for the employees, the community that the company's based in. I mean, we've seen some of those broad-based schemes out there. Let's talk about those,
yeah. But can you really tick the ownership box with those?
Well, let's ask the question.
So The issue is that the BE codes make a provision for what they call broad-based ownership structures in the codes. And there are a whole bunch of rules saying that in the event that a community is the beneficiary of a broad-based ownership scheme, that you can attribute black ownership to the company, provided all the rules are met.
Okay.
But, and I say but once again, is that many of the applications of broad-based schemes violate those original principles because the community members are not even aware that they are beneficiaries of a scheme, for instance. They never consider their vote in terms of electing fiduciaries or trustees to a broad-based trust. They have no say over what happens to potentially the distribution of dividends that might take place to the broad-based scheme. So again, you are violating those core principles around ownership vests in the hands of an individual. So even though the BE codes make provision for board-based trusts, in the drafting of these trusts that I've seen in practice, the rights of the individual are so diluted or so removed from the ownership principles that it seems almost like a front, one could say, if you claim black ownership, but there's actually a complete disconnect. Now, what one has to remember is that broad-based communities can benefit extensively from having black ownership in businesses because they now have an access to funding, dividend funding, and growth capital that they would never have got before. But
which hopefully gets reinvested in the community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the problem that of many of these schemes that I've seen is that effectively the founder of the trust, normally the company, has so much say over who gets the benefit, how the benefit gets distributed, whether someone qualifies or doesn't qualify for the benefit, that effectively they have ultimate control. And that is not the purpose of ownership. Ownership means that the control, the voting rights, etc., of the shares that you hold should vest in you.
Mm-hmm.
Just listening to all of that, Mario, I'm just thinking, how many other loopholes are there in this whole sort of process? You know, obviously we know the greater objective is the, you know, empowerment, social good, and redress. But if you're a company and you have a community that you want to empower, then where do you begin? Who do you talk to who then make sure all these loopholes get closed?
So I think one must remember that one of the general principles of BEE says that the spirit should trump the legal form.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing often is that the legal construction of trust agreements is very watertight, very clever.
Mm-hmm.
But the spirit is lost.
Okay.
Particularly the spirit of uplifting a community, whatever the case, or your employees. So where we all understand what the spirit is, very clever legal drafting means that the legal form, you cannot fault the legal form.
Mm-hmm.
But
it will always be there.
It'll always be. But the spirit is never achieved.
Okay.
Now, Mary, I mean, okay, so the trust structure's one element that we need to think about. Within the ownership environment, you've also got things like modified flow through principles that apply. Talk to us a little about, because I know there's now a little bit of noise in the system about modified flow through as well, and that's raising its head.
So I think the reason that the noise around modified flow through has arisen is because since the new codes were released, which were effective May 2015, companies that are 51% or more black owned can claim to be a level 2 status, automatic level 2 status, if their turnover is less than 50 million rand.
Okay.
Which means that's a reasonable size business. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing 50 million rand turnover, you're a reasonable size business. And previously, under the old codes, those companies would have had to do a whole bunch of things to get BE compliance. Now, if they can claim that they're 51% black owned, all they need to do is issue an affidavit saying, I'm 51% black owned, and there's no further commitment to BEE. No need for training, no need for social development, no mm-hmm. need for any of those other aspects of BEE. So there's a huge drive for companies that are under 50 million rand turnover to really look at, can I be 51% black owned and avoid all these implementation costs of BEE? Then there's a principle contained in the BEE codes called the modified flow through principle. And what this basically says is that where a company is owned, say, by another company, like a holding company subsidiary relationship, where a subsidiary is owned by a holding company, and that holding company is 51% black owned.
Mm-hmm.
The subsidiary can treat that holding company as if it's 100% black owned and then claim its black ownership, its resulting black ownership. So let's say, for instance, you have a company that's 51% owned by a holding company that's also 51% black owned.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you might have a white shareholder who owns 49% of the holding company
mm-hmm.
and 49% of the subsidiary. So the same white guy owning the holding company and the subsidiary 49% in each. If you did the maths, you would work out that the white shareholder has an effective shareholding of 74% of the underlying company,
mm-hmm.
but he can still claim 51% black ownership of the underlying or subsidiary company, because there's this deeming provision called the modified flow through, which says the holding company is deemed to be 100% black owned, even though it's only 51% black owned.
Yep.
Now, the issue there is, I'm a white business owner. I want to avoid BEE costs, so I want my company to be 51% black owned. I create a holding company structure. I'm a 49% shareholder in that holding company. I remain a 49% shareholder in my subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
I claim 51% black ownership using modified flow through. Effectively, I'm still 74% in control of my own business.
But you're not in control because you've given up voting control.
And again, this is where clever legal drafting creates minority protections that ultimately give me control over the business. Election of directors, for instance, I might say that there are only two directors of which I have to be one. So effectively a 50-50 kind of situation arises in those instances.
Mm.
So one... And if one's really smart about how you do these structures, you put multiple black shareholders into the holding company structure and you dilute the control that way.
But this is not what you're advocating, Mario. I think we need to be very clear, right?
I'm telling you what I'm seeing in the marketplace at the moment.
Hmm.
And the concern which is raised by Richard here is this modified flow-through principle is being abused by companies to avoid the spirit of BEE once again. Because the principle of modified flow through isn't there to allow a company like the one I described, in which I'm effectively a 74% shareholder, to avoid BEE.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really to assist those emerging black entrepreneurs who own 51% of their companies to not have to undergo the BEE compliance until their business is at least a sustainable business. And that's where that 50 million threshold comes in. So, again, there's another principle where the legal form is trumping the spirit of what is intended.
Okay. You know, obviously we can go on and I think, Richard, we need to consistently have these conversations. Because, I mean, the other question that I want to ask you, Murray, is that with all that's happening on the triple BEE side, how does that then align with some of the changes we hear taking place from the procurement side? You know, I just heard that, you know, the law is going to be repealed, triple PFA.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you just briefly speak to that in terms of how these two things align or misalign?
So there is a definite move to try and align the triple PFA with the objectives of BEE. And the primary mechanism for doing that is in the awarding of points for tenders. And at the moment, the way the triple PFA is drafted is that if you have a black-owned company with very good BE credentials, you earn more points on your tender. And the idea is to try and align these two pieces of legislation, is to allow for more points on any tender for companies that have a good BE level and have got black ownership. And that alignment process is taking place. So we've already seen the draft triple PFA come out, which is rewarding more points for companies that are black-owned with higher BE levels. Whereas in the past, under the current dispensation, a company with a very low BE score but is prepared to discount its price can still win a tender because the points awarded for price are more than the points awarded for empowerment. So that we are seeing an emphasis on empowerment as a way of making a procurement decision, particularly in government, using the triple PFA.
Okay, great stuff. Richard, final thoughts?
Yeah, I just think the challenges of ownership, I think, are for me, seem to be a
sticky point.
Well, it seems to be a moving goalpost.
Because, there's an emotion involved there.
Well, it's a moving goalpost because you see the codes. The codes get interpreted. You structure accordingly. And then, you know, the structures that you've created, everybody goes, oh, no, that wasn't our intent. We had a different intent. And I go, hey, people understand that, you know, business people actually want to get on with running their businesses as opposed to spending their days redoing structures. And, you know, at the end of the day, unfortunately, you know, if you look at the numbers, the flight of capital is there. It's real. And people just say, you know what, the whole principle of where's it easy to do business within this country, you know, if you don't get this right, we're going to pack and go somewhere else where it's a little easier to do business. And that's a real risk that we're facing. And as a country, we can't really afford to have business people that have got stable businesses, that have got good quality businesses, that have got good skills base. You can't afford to have them leaving and going elsewhere because they're looking for clarity and something. And I guess the thing is clarity and simpleness. What exactly do you want? Can I work under those yes or no? I'm in or I'm out. But the problem is the constant moving goalposts, the constant vagaries and the constant issues. And I go, oh, people understand.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, Richard, what EFF would say. They'll say those people can go.
And unfortunately,
And nature does not allow for a vacuum. So someone will come in. It could be the Chinese. It could be anybody else. So, Mari, just one final question from me. What is one thing that gives you hope about this whole process, if there's anything?
I know there's absolutely hope. And I think the hope that I get out of being in this industry, in the BE industry, is that well-thought-out BE policy that's executed in a sensible way contributes to growth. I've seen it time and time again where companies that approach BE with the right spirit and they apply their BE compliance requirements in the right way unlock growth in their businesses every time. And that's what gives me hope.
And as an ordinary South African, how can I know who those companies are?
Well, I suppose the best way is to look at companies that have got good BE credentials that are growing. You know, look at the ones that are performing.
Okay.
Because there are very few industries left in the country where you can completely ignore BEE and still think that you're going to have a long-term growth strategy. And I always charge the executives that are the people running these businesses. If BEE and strategy are not on your board agenda at every board meeting under the leadership of a senior person, typically the CEO, I believe, you are making a strategic error in your business. And only at the point in time where the CEO takes personal responsibility as to the company's transformation and growth strategy does BE sit at the right place at the table. And where I have many clients where it is a CEO KPI, and those companies are the ones that are getting it right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, fantastic. Mario, as always, a pleasure. I think we should have you back here because, as I can tell, I've got more questions. Richard has more questions.
I think there's so many questions that remain unanswered.
You know. So, but with that, we'd like to say thank you, Mario.
Very cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, after this brief break, we'll go right into the Youth Leadership Platform show in association with Student Brands. This will be driven by Louis, Chanel, and Muzi.
This is CliffCentral.com.